If you have your Bibles, turn while we get some things set up. Turn to Genesis chapter 12. There is so much when we think of and contemplate this statement, Israel and the Palestinian Arab problem. And I am purposely putting those words there, Palestinian Arab. And you'll understand here in a little bit, I think, as we work through this. Not just Palestinians, though those that live there want to consider themselves Palestinian as if they are natives of that piece of territory. And if you want to look in your Bibles in the back and on maps, you can, to consider those things, but what is that land called before Abraham comes? Canaan. It's called the land of Canaan. And Palestine comes in much later in history for that area, which they have picked up, and it's kind of an offshoot of Philistines, if you will. But they are Arabs, primarily. Some may be Egyptian, some may be Syrian, some may be of Lebanese background, Jordanian background, but they all are Arabs, and they affirm that themselves. They consider themselves Arabs, and so I put it purposely Palestinian Arabs because they're not Palestinians, because there has never been a Palestine as a state, if you will, a place to be from, like the United States or Germany or France, where you have a nationality, as it were, that you're from. Palestine has never been that, in order for someone to be a Palestinian. But they call themselves that, and they do it purposely, because they try to create the narrative that Israelites are usurpers to this area. When in actuality, it is the other way around. I don't know how many have seen it, and I don't have it in my slides, but a few weeks ago, shortly after the attacks by Hamas on Israel, Benjamin Netanyahu did a brief, I'm assuming an interview, so there may be a larger context, but there is a video out of Benjamin Netanyahu taking just a few minutes, and from just a secular history, if you will. He doesn't bring up the scriptures. He doesn't bring up his Old Testament, but just notes that the Jews have been in this land for 3,500 years. And the Palestinians, the Arabs, are the usurpers. They're the colonialists who came in, and I appreciated what he had to say. It wasn't derogatory against the Palestinians, the Arabs that have come. But he's just laying out the history in cold, hard facts and letting folks know, we've been here. This is our land. He didn't say that God gave it to them, yet we know God gave it to them. But I appreciate what he had to say when I came across this. And again, from strictly what we would consider a secular standpoint, because again, he's not bringing in God into the mixture. He's just noting history. But as we look at this and we see what's going on, it is somewhat the talk of the town, is it not? I was in Walmart, was it Monday or previous time? But I was in the checkout line, and there were three young people behind me, college age-ish, a young man and two young ladies. And the man was doing a lot of the talking, but it sounds like they had been involved in some protesting down in Wichita, I think having to do with this conflict in the Middle East. They were not pro-Israeli. They were pro-Hamas in their confrontations with these things. But I was just listening to them talk, and I could tell that their mindset was not of a conservative bent. Which also reminds me, conspiracy theories do not know a political side. You hear a lot of people speak of the right being very much wrapped up with conspiracy theories. I was listening to them, and this young man who was talking rather knowingly, at least in his mind, somehow got off onto the Kennedy assassination. You're a 20-something. I don't remember the Kennedy assassination because I was all of just over 2 years old when it happened. But as far as he was concerned, it was a government-done thing. Lee Harvey Oswald worked for the government, and the government took the president out. Okay, conspiracy theories do not hold precedent for any one political framework. But I was just listening to them and thought, how much are people really listening and reading things and really searching out for the truth? And we need to be careful with where we look for our sources of truth, especially in this day and age, because you know our media is all over when it comes to trying to tell us or portray for us what's out there. Everybody has their agenda, and they want to paint things according to their agenda. And as I was working through some of this and doing some studying and looking, I was really pleased with finding some good websites that gave us some good, sound information of the background. Britannica.com, which is, for those of us that are older, that used to get encyclopedias in our home, you know, the Britannica, the Encyclopedia Britannica was kind of the gold standard. That was the Cadillac. I think Mom and Dad got Collier's, not Britannica, back in the day. And they have continued with a good standard. I don't know that I would give them a 100% recommendation for every article, but in looking at some of the history, considering it's Britannica, meaning that it is of a British background and source, the writers, the compilers, did a very good job because it doesn't paint a pretty picture of the British back 100 years ago. And they didn't try to whitewash it. They didn't try to gloss over these things. They noted the truth. They noted what took place. These are the things that were going on. So encourage you, if you want to follow up on some of this, go to Britannica.com and do some looking through their articles. Another place that I came across was the WilsonCenter.org. I didn't look at the background of it. I'm wondering if it's not founded off of Woodrow Wilson, but it is a Congress-chartered site that does research, that does looking up articles and filing articles, and they did one on Hamas on October 23rd of this year, and telling us the doctrine of Hamas. Now, this information is available for all of our elected officials. And I'm wondering why our elected officials haven't read it to find out what it is Hamas is doing, what it wants to do. And so there again, not a 100% endorsement of the WilsonCenter.org, but again, I found things that were not trying to gloss over. They were just, this is what Hamas has said, this is what Hamas has in its documents, this is Hamas, and it's here for you to read. And again, if anybody would read it and stop and consider, is that something to be rejoicing in what they've done? I think people's eyes would be awakened and say, oh, I need to rethink what I'm doing here. So I give those out to you to, well, if you again want to look at further. But as we look at this issue, and we're on, I want us to consider these things. And again, there is so much. I will try to, I think, be able to get through what I have tonight in a good time. But Palestinians, as we've already kind of noted, are not descendants from the various ites that we have noted in the Old Testament passages, the Jebusites, the Perizzites, the Hittites, And on the list goes as you read through the Old Testament. They don't claim to be descendants of them. From what we know of history, those ites disappeared. They were either assimilated into others or they died off as those ites. But they do identify as Arab, and they identify themselves as descendants of Ishmael. I said Genesis 12. If you want to turn over to Genesis chapter 25, Genesis chapter 25, verses 12 through 18, as we see the descendants of Ishmael, it says, these are the generations of Ishmael, Abraham's son, whom Hagar the Egyptian, Sarah's handmaid, bare unto Abraham. And these are the names of the sons of Ishmael, by their names according to their generations. The firstborn of Ishmael, Nebajoth, Kedar, Adbeel, Mibsam, Mishma, Duma, Masa, Hadar, Tema, Jetur, Naphish, and Kedema. These are the sons of Ishmael, and these are their names by their towns and by their castles. 12 princes according to their nations. These are the years of the life of Ishmael, 137 years. And he gave up the ghost and died, and was gathered unto his people. And they dwelt from Havilah unto Shur, that is before Egypt, as thou goest toward Assyria. And he died in the presence of all his brethren. Now we have his 12 princes, which are noted back prophetically to Hagar earlier on. We see their names, and we see the area that they will eventually live in, from Havilah unto Shur. And if you have a study Bible, most note have being located somewhere in central Arabia, north of modern Yemen. And Shur, if you were to look at your map in the Old Testament that has, I would say, the Exodus map, you would see that Shur, the wilderness of Shur, is kind of in the northern area of the Sinai Peninsula, up near the Mediterranean Sea. So if you had a broader map to see things, you would see that it's from Shur, an area, over to Havilah, a community somewhere in the Arabian Peninsula, is where Ishmael's descendants come from and where the Arabs claim to be from Arabia. So we have those noted. When you look back at chapter 16, again, going back to seeing some of the prophecy, Genesis, concerning Ishmael, chapter 16, verses 11 and 12, as I recall, this is where Hagar has left and will come back and then leave once again. But in verses 11 and 12 of 16, it says, "And the angel of the Lord said unto her," that is unto Hagar, "Behold, thou art with child, and shalt bear a son, and shalt call his name Ishmael, because the Lord hath heard thy affliction. And he will be a wild man, and his hand will be against every man, and every man's hand against him. And he shall dwell in the presence of all his brethren." Now God gives to Hagar and to us, because it's in the scriptures here, a little bit of prophecy about Ishmael and his descendants. They're not going to be a very nice people to be around. You'd be a wild man. They're going to be having their hands against every man and every man's hand against them. And when we look at the history of Arabia, you find that to be true. And it's still going on to this day. Various tribes, clans, if you will, of the Arabs fighting other clans and tribes of the Arabs. Yemen is having that happening right now. The Houthis are fighting another tribe within Yemen for preeminence within the country of Yemen. And if for those of you that may have seen, you see some of it in Hollywood's movie Lawrence of Arabia with Peter O'Toole, going back to World War I when the British were trying to get those Arab tribes together to fight against the Ottoman Turks. Now, they're all Muslim, but the Turks were, in the Ottoman Empire, were ruling, quote-unquote, the Arab Peninsula to some extent. And since the Turks were with Germany and the hostile powers against Britain, Britain was trying to get those Arab troops to be on their side so that they could fight the Ottomans in the Middle East. Now, yes, that eventually happens, but you know, in that movie, they note the various clans trying to come together, and they're all upset with each other. And Lawrence is able to, you know, appease them and bring them together and mold them into a fighting unit to fight against the Turks. But in that initial coming together, they're all, you know, upset with each other because they have their petty differences over various things that are going on. So, you know, history has showed us that this prophecy is indeed true about these people. They haven't liked each other, and they don't like others around them, and that just has historically been the case without bringing in Islam into the mix. That eventually is going to come, but that's not noted in because there is no Islam in God talking to Hagar in Hagar's time. Muhammad hasn't come yet. So there is no Islam being involved in this. It will come later. So we see that prophecy, you know, coming, ringing true. When we look at Abraham and his descendants, again, I think we understand this. We see that this land of Canaan, this promised land, the land where they are at today, we find was given to them by God under specifically the Abrahamic covenant that we have noted here and these various passages, and we'll not look at them. Again, I went to Genesis chapter 12, where God calls Abram out of Ur of the Chaldees to a land that he will show him. And all these iterations of it, if you will, are God reaffirming to Abraham that this is your land. This land, and he will give the dimensions to it eventually, is going to belong to you and your children, your descendants. This is your land. God gave it to them. We can't get around that. I know the world tries to get around that. But we can't. Whether they want to affirm that there is a God or not is in our understanding of all this, immaterial. Because Israel is Israel because God called them. God chose them. And in essence, people must come to terms with that one way or another. It is, to me, that is the biggest question mark for people to answer. Why is there an Israel? You've got to go to the Bible to find that out. Yes, they can look at secular history and see, but they eventually have to come back to the Bible, which is at least a stepping point for us to discuss then why there is an Israel. Because of God. Whether you believe in that God or not, it doesn't matter. It's like the old bumper sticker, and I think Jim's talked about it, the old bumper sticker that was out there, God said it. The old bumper sticker had three lines. The middle line we could do without, in a sense. God said it, I believe it, that settles it. Take out the middle one, put it at the bottom. God said it, that settles it. We do need to believe it. But God is the one that brought them into existence. He chose them, Abraham and his descendants. We see in the other points as we work our way down through, that covenant is confirmed with Isaac because Abraham has several sons, does he not? He does. He has Ishmael, which we've already looked at, a human attempt to fulfill what God had told Abraham and Sarah. You're going to have a son. They try through physical means that were common in that day, to bring in a surrogate mother to have this son. God said no. And we see the results of that seemingly innocent act cause them problems. We also know that Abraham, after Sarah's death, will marry again, Keturah, and have more children. And we're not even addressing them because they don't really fit in our mix here. But they too are blessed. It's interesting how God told Abraham, I'm going to bless your offspring. And he blesses all those offspring. But we see it confirmed through Isaac, not Ishmael. Now the Arabs, the Muslims, will take issue with us. They believe the Bible, but they also believe the Quran and the teachings of Muhammad that seek to clear up some problems they perceive to be in the Bible, and this is one of them. That it's Isaac, not Ishmael. It's Isaac that goes to Mount Moriah that's offered, not Isaac. And we're at an impasse to try to talk to them about that. Because it's the Bible against what their beliefs are. We believe Isaac went there. Isaac's the chosen one. Muslims believe that it's Ishmael. In a sense, can either one of us prove it apart from our sacred scriptures? We cannot. We weren't there. Is the Bible true? Yes. Is it authoritative? Yes. Who does God record for us went to Mount Moriah with Abraham? Isaac. I will hold to that. There's no, to me, there is no issue here. We've got to address Islam in a different vein, if you will. We can't go that route because neither one of us can prove our point to the satisfaction of the other. There are many other things that we could go to try to address the Quran and their beliefs, yes. But on this point, we can't. But it is confirmed through Isaac, none of the other sons. Does Isaac have one son or two? He has two. There's twins, Esau and Jacob. And God confirms this covenant with Jacob. Lastly, in point four, it's confirmed with Jacob's sons as we see that prophecy, if you will, that Jacob has to his 12 sons in Genesis chapter 49. And so we see this lineage come down, if you will, of this covenant that God has given to Abraham and his offspring, that this land, the land of Canaan, is the promised land that I'm going to give you. This covenant is an unconditional one. When we look in the scriptures, there are covenants that are unconditional, and there are covenants that are conditional. In this regard, this is an unconditional covenant. God didn't tell to Abraham and all these succeeding generations, this is your land as long as you do this. If you don't do this or you do this, then it's no longer your land. It's ultimately God's land, and he calls it that through the scriptures. But he gave it to Abraham and his offspring with no conditions. Now we know in later, under Moses, does God through Moses tell them that he may remove them out of that land? Yes. You look in the book of Deuteronomy and you find those statements. You obey me and you have my blessings. You disobey me and you'll eventually go into captivity. But he never records that the land isn't theirs, even though they have been taken off into captivity. It's still their land. I think we understand that. If we have bought a parcel of land, and it's all paid for, and we remove from that land and live someplace else, is that still our land? What if somebody comes and squats on it? Is it still our land? Yes. Why? Because we have the title deed to it. We were the ones that paid for it. It's ours. But there's somebody living there. Is it their land? No, it's ours. And so I think we understand that because of those principles, if you will. And so the land is theirs, whether they were living in it or not, because God gave it to them. We've seen them come and go from the land to some extent. It's interesting as we see that, not completely eliminated from the land. We see the Assyrian captivity takes the northern 10 tribes, but are there still Jews living in the land? Yes. A little bit later, Babylon takes the southern tribes, but are there still Jews living in the land? Yes. Jeremiah is still there. They leave the poor of the land there. There are still Jews living there. And so again, going back to Benjamin Netanyahu, noting there's always been Jews living there. They may not have been the majority, but Jews have always been living in that land since the days of Joshua, when they conquered the land. So as we note this unconditional one, it has not been fully realized by Abraham's descendants. When we look at those dimensions that he gives to us, to the river Euphrates, and again, if you want to look at a map in the back at some point and see where the river Euphrates is in regards to where Israel is, we have the Mediterranean Sea, we have the Jordan River, we have those other boundaries. They've never existed to that extent. That takes in what we know as part of Lebanon and Syria, part of Iraq. They've never had that much land. Never. And yet God has said, those are your boundaries. And so as I put dot, 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 yet there's coming a day when they will have that land according to God's promise. But let's move on, if you will, to find out a little more of what's going on. We know that it belongs to the Israelites. The Palestinian Arabs are there. We know where they've come from. But we bring in a religious mix because Islam arises out of the Central Arabian Peninsula after the death of its founder, Muhammad. Under subsequent leaders, the Arab Empire, or the Muslim Empire, expands out of Arabia to the west into North Africa and eventually into the Iberian Peninsula, i.e. Spain, Portugal, to the east through Persia and on to India, to the north into the rest of the Middle East and into the Balkans of the southeastern Europe. The Dark Ages that we think of is a time when the Arabs expand out of the Arab Peninsula, Arabian Peninsula, and conquer for Allah. And they conquer by sword or forced conversions. And they become really an empire, all based on Islam. Following the tenets of Muhammad and his followers, his subsequent leaders. And when Islam conquers the Promised Land, the relative peace that has existed in the region for hundreds of years is disrupted. This is going back to the times of pilgrimages by Europeans. Again, we're looking at, you know, the first, you know, 600 years after Christ. Believers are making pilgrimages to the Holy Land, as it's called. Going to Bethlehem, going to Nazareth, going to the Sea of Galilee. And once the Muslims come in and take over, those things stop. Now, yes, it is Catholic fueled. They're the ones doing this, you know, get your works in so you can somehow get to heaven kind of thing. But until Islam, there has been a relative peace amongst the people that are there, be they Jews, be they Arabs who aren't Muslim at this point, Christians, they're living there not in a perfect idyllic harmony. This is not a utopia. But they're able to come and go. But when Islam comes in with their belief system that they are the superior, you are the inferior, you either become a Muslim or you become a servant to us and you lose a lot of your identity or we kill you. That kind of puts a hamper on people trying to come see Bethlehem or come see the holy sites. And I don't like to use that term, but that's, you know, going back into the context of that time, that's what they're called. They're not, you know, we'd like to take trips to the promised land, do we not? Some of us have. See the sites where our Savior has been, see those sites. It's beautiful. It's wonderful. That's what they were doing back in those days. Now, yes, for religious purposes, but they were going there to see those, and now that is not able to be done. And so you have then a problem. As we see, the Jews and Christians are subjugated, they're enslaved by Islam, Christian pilgrimages are disrupted, and so you come then to Pope Urban II, in 1095 AD, calling for crusades. And you will hear Muslims talk about this to this day, as if it's a bad thing. Well, for them, it is. But the Pope of the Roman Catholic Church in 1095 calls on Christians, and I put that term loosely, calls on the European believers, and I again use that term loosely, to rise up and let's go to the Holy Land and fight against the Muslims to regain what has been ours to visit for centuries. And thus starts then 200 years of crusades. In the end, it ultimately is a failure. They have some success along the way, but they have their own problems. I mean, if you want to, it sounds grandiose and it sounds great on the surface, but when you read of the Crusades, you find that some of true believers are killed because these crusaders get sidetracked along the way with very others who aren't believing like the Roman Catholic Church and go after them. And they go after the Eastern Church in Constantinople as well, and just a lot of infighting. And ultimately, while they gain some ground, they eventually really just lose the rest of that ground. And after 200 years of trying to make this an open place for Christians to come and see again, it kind of disappears. It becomes a fruitless effort, wasted manpower, wasted lives, and they aren't able to do that completely what they wanted to do. And yet, it is what the Muslims will look at with a bad view of Christians. And they will say, well, you Christians came and fought against us. Well, personally, as a Christian, I didn't come and fight against you, and those that I identify with historically did not fight against you. Those that believe as I believe, or very closely to it back in those centuries, were being hunted by the people that were fighting you because they saw my progenitors back there as heretics. And so mine weren't part of that. But we see those things happening. Let's move on. And so even though Islam ruled over the Holy Land for hundreds of years, again, there have been Jews living in that land since the days of Joshua's conquest. They've been there. And then we have this interesting thing happen in the late 1800s. And I say interesting. It's called Zionism, and to some, that's a bad term, even to this day. within Judaism, within the Jews, it is a good term. It is their desire to return to the land God promised them. That's all, really, that's all that Zionism is. Some have taken it to some extremes, yes. And we'll not go down those roads, but just kind of generally speaking, Zionism is the desire within the Jewish community to return to their land of promise. And it is interesting that it came about in the late 1800s and continues to this day. You have Jews continuing to return to that land. And when I say Jews, any Jew. The secular Jew that has no religious ties to their heritage. Yes, those that are religious, the observant Jews of various degrees, they're wanting to go back to the land that God promised them. And they're coming from places where they have a family history. Whether it be Russia, whether it be Ukraine, whether it be the United States, wherever. Where does that desire come from? It comes from God. I mean, where else can you put that from? When we look at the scriptures, and we'll not go there, but when you read Daniel chapter 9, and God gives us that vision that he has of the 70 weeks for Daniel for the people of Israel, you find that they're in the land in unbelief. Because it notes a temple. If the Jews are there in belief, do they need a temple? No. A believing Jew doesn't need the temple. Does an observant Mosaic holding Jew who doesn't believe in their Messiah, do they need a temple? Yes. And the Jews are ready to build their temple. They have the materials that they need. They're just waiting for that right time to build that temple. So when we look at Daniel chapter 9 and understand that prophetic picture, they're coming back in unbelief having a temple that is going to eventually be, you know, desecrated by the Antichrist. But there's a temple there in unbelief. But we see them coming back to the land. It continues on to this day. We move forward from the 1800s. World War I brought the collapse of the Ottoman Empire, which was ruling that area in the 1800s. But they were on the wrong side of history, if you will. The Ottoman Empire was also known as the sick man of Europe. They were already on their way out. They had had their own problems in the 1800s within their empire. It was shrinking, and they were having, you know, kind of infighting. But with France and Britain, the United States coming into the war, they're on the winning side. And so the Balfour Declaration is there to do something with the Ottoman Empire. Now that they've lost, to the victor go the spoils. And if you know World War I history, you know the victors wanted to exact vengeance against their enemies. And sets us up for World War II. But here with the Ottoman Empire, looking at the Balfour Declaration, moved forward the idea of a Jewish state in Palestine. By now it's called Palestine, that area, the Promised Land. Britons were desirous of seeing that happen because a lot of the Zionists are in Britain, some of the founding men, if you will, and they've had some influence within the British politics of trying to get us our own land. Some have been looking at other places around the world, but that's not the land of Israel. The land of promise is a special spot, a special place. And so that is narrowed down, and the Balfour Declaration moves forward that idea. Let's have a Jewish state in Palestine. The League of Nations, conceived by President Woodrow Wilson, but the U.S. never entered into it. It's the precursor to our United Nations of today, but Woodrow Wilson is the conceiver of the League of Nations. And Europe accepts it, but I think rightly so. The United States Congress said, we don't want to be a part of this. They wanted to be out of European affairs. We didn't want to be in the war to begin with, but we did. But the League of Nations then creates, again, looking at what to do with the Ottoman Empire, they create the French and British mandates to oversee what was once the Ottoman Empire territory. The French mandate would cover what we know today as Lebanon and Syria, kind of the northern part of our area. The British mandate would cover Palestine and what is called at that time Transjordan, or what we know as Jordan today, pretty much the configuration that we see in a map here in a little bit of Transjordan is what Jordan is today. So with those mandates, and with England controlling Palestine and Transjordan, we see that there is created a two-state solution. There's Palestine and there's Transjordan. Transjordan will eventually become, as we note there, the Hashemite Kingdom of Jordan. That's the official name. I mean, we call it Jordan, but their official name is the Hashemite Kingdom of Jordan. Hashemite is the tribe of Arabs that are able to have control of that area. That happens, you know, after World War I. The mandates take place in the early 1920s, and Britain is the one controlling this. Jews have been coming into the land for several decades now. They're still very much the minority, but tensions start to arise because the local Arabs are seeing these others come in, these Jewish invaders, to use their terms, coming. Britain is trying to keep the peace. And again, as when you look at more of the history of this, you find that the British that are in Palestine are more on the side of the Arabs. Whereas back in England, Parliament and the powers that be there are more on the side of the Israelites. Which, does that not cause a problem? It does. And World War II is going to put a pause in those efforts, but there's a lot of pulling going back and forth. There are some skirmishes amongst the Arabs and the Jews during those decades as Israel is wanting what the League of Nations has promised, a state, a home to call their own. The Arabs do not want that. And we'll get to some maps here to show some of this in a moment. Finally, as you come to that last paragraph, Britain left on May 14th. They kind of put their hands up and said, enough's enough. We're out of here. We want out. They couldn't find a good solution for the Arab-Jewish issue. The Jews, we want the land that you told us that we would have. You told us we would have a country. We're here. We want a country. Arabs, you want a state? Yes, no. We don't want the Jews here. So we don't want a state if the Jews are here. And they have held to that stance for the last 100 years. The Arabs living there do not want a state if Israel's there. Let's move on. I think we have maps coming. Here's the British mandate. And we note, you see pretty much that is Israel. Whoops. The purple is what we know as Israel, pretty much. And the stripes are what we know as Jordan pretty much to this day. So again, we see a two-state solution that was already given. We hear it again today. So let's move to the next one. This was the UN's partition plan in 1947. As they are talking to the powers that be, Arabs, this is your state. The kind of the tan within the white. The white part is the Jewish state. They wanted Jerusalem to be an international city, kind of a free zone. It doesn't belong to either party. What did the Arabs say? No. We don't want this. So when we hear talk of a two-state solution to this day, it does go all the way back 100 years. And we have, in historically, one party say no. And they've continued to this day to say no. Because the one party doesn't want the other party there. So when we hear phrases like, from the river to the sea, they mean all of the white. Hamas, any Arab that is there that speaks of the river to the sea, means we want Israel out of here. It's not they want equality. It's not that they want to live peacefully with others. I know some of our politicians have tried to gloss over and tell us that that's what that means. It does not. It never has. The Arabs that live there do not want Jews there, period. The two-state solution has continued to go forward. Israel has said yes to this. They said yes to this in 1947. But again, the other side said no. So that brings us then to when Israel declares its independence on that same day that Britain removed the last of their people. On May 14th, 1948, Israel, I mean, what can they do? The powers that be that have been overseeing this have now left. There are no British soldiers there to try to keep the peace. Israel declares their independence. United Nations, you've given us this. We've said yes. We're going to call for our independence. We're a nation now. The United States, Truman will eventually say yes. We accept them as a nation, and others will follow suit. But as soon as they declare that, those neighbors around Israel who are Muslim invade. So Lebanon invades, Syria invades, Jordan invades, Egypt invades, and we have the War of Independence, which lasts for about a year. The fighting ceases. They call it an armistice. The fighting ceases in 1949, and this is what we have for the new territory. We have the Gaza Strip, as it's been called, is taken over by Egyptian control. What is called the West Bank in green was taken over by the Jordanian troops that crossed the Jordan River. Now, if we were to go back and look at that partition map, is part of the green part of the Arab state that could have been? Yes. But if the Arabs don't want a state, then whose is it? In this case, it's up for grabs. And the Jordanians and these others know that. And the line ends there because that's the best that they can do. Israel cannot gain more territory in their independent fight. They get this. You have the other control, the demilitarized zones up around the Sea of Galilee. The upper part is part of what we know as the Golan Heights of today. They're mountains. Again, the Jordan River is below sea level, so that line that divides Jordan and Israel is a river, the Jordan River, that comes out from Mount Hermon north of Israel, goes through the Sea of Galilee, and ends in the Dead Sea. That's all below sea level. The Sea of Galilee is below sea level. So when you're on the Sea of Galilee, you look up at the land around you. It's not like a lake that we might find here where you kind of, okay, yeah, there's a slight little dip and we get down to the lake and that's it. No, you're looking up at the hillsides. The hillsides might be above sea level, but the Sea of Galilee is not. So those Golan Heights, Syria controlled, and will cause a problem to Israel in the valley below them. But that is the armistice agreement that has been, in one sense, been in place in a way until 1967. There's some skirmishes in the mid-50s, again, we'll not touch on that because there's nothing really happens. But in 1967, in the Six-Day War, again, Israel is attacked by its neighbors. The invading forces gain an upper hand, but quickly Israel routs them. And, move me forward. They are able to take over the West Bank. They take over Gaza. They push the Egyptians all the way back, actually to the Nile River in Egypt. So Israel takes control of the Sinai Peninsula. They take over the West Bank. They take over Gaza. And they are able to get the Golan Heights. There's an older movie about a Jewish spy. He was an Eastern Jew, so he looked very much like a Syrian. And he infiltrated the Syrian hierarchy to find out where the emplacements were that the Syrians had in the Golan Heights. They had guns and stuff that the Israelis couldn't take out because they didn't know where they were. But this man, Eli Cohen, was able to go in and get that information and bring it back. Eli Cohen's body is still somewhere in Syria. It's never been returned. They have a bitter hatred because he went way up in the military rank, not as an officer, but he got up into the military ranks of knowing generals and people in charge of things and won their confidences so that he could view them and then record them and bring it back to Israel. And so Israel knew in 67 when that war took place, they knew where those emplacements were and could take them out. Because the Syrians had been using it to lob, you know, anything that they wanted to into Israel. And Israel really couldn't fight back because they couldn't find where those emplacements were. So they were being bombed, shelled, and that's taken out. So Israel takes out the Golan Heights, giving them some freedom there in the northern part of Israel from Syrians doing what they had been doing through the years in harassing, if you will, Israel. So they have the West Bank. They take over Israel. They take over Jerusalem, all of Jerusalem, and they rejoice in that. The Israelis do. In 1970, 1979, I got to remember, you formatted it differently. In 1979, Israel and Egypt struck an agreement, and by 1982, Israel had removed themselves from the Sinai Peninsula and established agreed-upon border with Egypt, which is still its border with Egypt today. So when we look at a modern map of Israel, that long line that goes from the Mediterranean Sea all the way down to the Gulf of Aqaba is what they agreed upon back then. Israel removed itself completely out of the Sinai Peninsula in that agreement and brings that southern border. As we know, moving forward with things, again, here's that understanding. They still occupy these other territories because they won it by virtue of the war. Besides the fact that God gave it to them, but they won it by virtue of the war. Excuse me, but they didn't want the Sinai Peninsula. They didn't need it. It wasn't theirs in a biblical sense. And so they return it to Egypt. And we move forward in time. And we find in 2005, Israel withdrew its settlements and occupation of the Gaza Strip. Let's back up. They removed themselves out of that little strip of land down there. They're not building settlements. They remove all their Jewish residents. They remove their occupation out of the Gaza Strip, leaving it for Palestinian self-control. It's theirs. Do with it, Arabs, as you wish. The Palestinians elect Hamas to govern them. Hamas is a group that comes out of the Muslim Brotherhood in the 1980s, and it has one purpose: the elimination of Israel. Plain and simple, there have been no elections in Gaza since Hamas took over. Within the Palestinian Authority, as it's called, the ruling body of those Arabs that live in the Gaza Strip, that live in what is called the West Bank area, they have factions, if you will, the Fatah, PLO, Yasser Arafat, for those of us that go back in time and know that. That's them. Hamas is a little more radical, and their purpose is the elimination of Israel. And again, they've not allowed elections to take place since they took over. And as, again, we know from those that will give us the truth of what's happening, they use the Palestinian people as shields to conduct their terrorist efforts against Israel. From 2005 on, they have been lobbying anything and everything over that border to harass Israel. It comes and goes. I think it mostly comes and goes as they're able to get stuff from Iran and any place else where they can get missiles and rockets and anything. They stockpile it. Once they think they have enough, they lob it over. When it's emptied, the fighting stops. They stockpile again and do this over and over and over again. Again, noting, as we note here, the Palestinian Arabs have repeatedly been given the opportunities to have their own nation over the past 100 years and have repeatedly rejected that option and instead wished to eliminate Israel. Why the world doesn't want to acknowledge and accept that, I do not know. But they do. It doesn't mean that Israel is perfect. That's usually the other flip side to this. Well, you're supporting Israel. I do not give them a blank check. We should support Israel. They're God's people. We've been told the blessings in the Abrahamic covenant. Those that bless you, God said, I will bless. Those that curse you, I will curse. That's part of that unconditional covenant. Do we want God's blessings? I do. Should I be supporting Israel? Yes, I should. Doesn't mean that we give them a blank check. They need to follow proper protocols, if you will. And we see by and large that they do. Israel could go in and, you know, move back to our map. That is not a very large, The Gaza Strip is not very large. As we noted back with one of the maps that I did hand out, the widest spot in Israel, which is pretty much from that corner of the Gaza Strip over to the bottom of the Dead Sea, is 62 miles. So if that's 62 miles, Gaza Strip is not that wide. There's not a lot of territory there. Israel could just go in and demolish the place. They have the means to. They could just bulldoze and just push everything off into the Mediterranean Sea. But they've chose not to. They have sought hard to take out those that are the terrorists causing the harm. Now, is it up to Israel to see that whatever comes in the aftermath of Hamas within the Palestinians, is that up to the Arab, to Israel to work out? No. That's up to the Palestinians. It's theirs. Israel said, it's yours, have it. You allowed Hamas to come in and rule you, and you have all sorts of problems with it. We're here to take out Hamas. And I say, let them take them out. Palestinians, live peaceably. You've been given this. It's yours. Live peaceably with your neighbors. What is going to be the aftermath of this? I don't know. As I said back then, it does make me anxious, if you will, in a good sense, that there may be a shout and a trumpet. We're not hearing a lot of saber rattling by their neighbors at this point. There's some rattling going on, yes. So what comes in the aftermath will remain, obviously, will remain to be seen. What is going to happen? Will Hezbollah step up its efforts in the north? They've been doing some, not as much as they could. Israel knows that they're jam-packed with munitions. But they haven't, I think, wisely so on their part. But, you know, the end of this remains to be seen what will happen. But is this the precursor for those things that we see coming in that we know are future events? I don't know. And I'm not about to say yes. For then we start setting dates, though we're not setting dates. We don't know the time, the hour, when Christ says it's time to take his church home. But we are near to that time. And to me, the events in the Middle East just are driving us to that. The Arab world, the Muslim world, does not want Israel to exist. They don't want us to exist, for that matter, either. Because we support Israel. But to me, it just leads us that God's timetable is at work and his program is going forward. Do we need to be upset, distraught? No. God's table is coming forward. We can pray for the peace of Israel, for the peace of Jerusalem, yes. He calls on us to do that. Psalm 122. The Israelites, again, they're not perfect, but they have sought to live in peace with their neighbors. when you look at Israel's political system, you will find that there are Arabs within parliament. That, I think, would be an eye-opening idea for many people to realize. But there are. There are Arabs that are in parliament in Israel that live peacefully in Israel. And they're part of their parliament. As they try to get their government together, they have to appease the various parties within the government, and part of those parties are the Arabs. Israel is a democracy. It's the only democracy in the Middle East that is not apartheid. You can't be apartheid and have those that are supposedly out within your government. You know, the apartheid of South Africa was blacks and whites. The blacks did not have part of the government. The whites controlled it. That was apartheid. Yes, it was oppressive. Blacks were second-class citizens and all of that. That doesn't take place in Israel. You can't call them apartheid and realize that they have Arabs within their parliament. That's not apartheid. It's just incendiary words to rouse up people to be against Israel. May we look at the truth that is there and live by it and accept what God's doing. Again, the aftermath of this, I don't know. But it has been in the works for a very long time. And half of this has not wanted a solution that's workable with the other half. And we need to understand that. The world needs to understand that. When you have two parties that are at odds with each other, and one party wants the elimination of the other, there is no common ground. That's genocide. And we can't be a part of it. So as we consider those things, may we help people to understand the truth that is there and accept the truth.